This conference has a very audacious title, as you all know, Life After Capitalism. And in the panels on Saturday and Sunday, I plan to time travel with all of you, I hope, to that place, that far-off place, and imagine what it might look like, and even to tell you about some of the times where I've actually felt that I was catching maybe a glimpse of what life after capitalism might look like. Most notably, I lived for 8 months last year in Argentina after the collapse that we saw in the film The Fourth World War, because I knew that whatever happened after that collapse, whatever was built in the rubble of that collapse, would be a clue for us about what kind of world we could build after capitalism. And something really remarkable happened in Argentina, which was that 200 factories that were facing closure, just as factories in this country have been closing down, the workers were told, you're about to lose your jobs. You know, global capital is mobile. Profits aren't what they used to be. And the workers looked around at the country in flames, and they looked at the fact that unemployment was at about between 40, was it about 40%? And they thought, I don't think so. And they locked themselves inside their factories, and they staged the reverse of a strike, in the sense that a strike is workers withholding their labor. And what they did is they refused to stop working. They said, guys, you can leave, but we're keeping the machines. Or if they were doctors and nurses, they said, we're keeping the x-ray machines, we're keeping the equipment, and we're going to keep it running. So I'm going to be talking about that a little on Sunday. I'm going to be showing clips from a film. But tonight, I have to ask your forgiveness, because tonight I feel the need to talk about death under capitalism and how we might act together at this crucial moment to stop the killing, to stop some of the killing. Because, as Michael said, the road to any better system in the future begins with meaningful acts of solidarity and mutual aid today. So that's why I want to talk about what's going on in Iraq. I want to talk about it because I believe it is our pressing and inescapable moral responsibility to use this moment, when so many of us are going to be coming together, to condemn in the most forceful, clear, possible way the atrocities that are currently unfolding in Iraq. Not just to condemn them. Not just to condemn them, but to make forceful and concrete demands for change. Now, everything is conspiring to make us feel that the protests are all about how we protest, that it's all about tactics. It's become basically postmodern. And there's very, very little discussion about what is actually driving us to the streets, what made us angry. And we need to get back to basics. We need to focus on less on where we protest and how we protest, and more on why we are protesting, what our goals are. What our goals are. Because direct action is about the result. It's not self-expression, it's not theater. It's about having an effect, and we need to get focused on what our goals are. My goal, one of them, let's just choose one, and I know many, all of you share this, is to end the occupation of Iraq. Yes. Now, that goal, unfortunately, has very little to do with the outcome of these elections. Bush and Kerry are both promising, openly bragging, that they are going to stay the course in Iraq. They are promising a long continuation of the brutality that we are seeing. Now, what matters, it's not that there's no hope. It's that we can't count on them in any way. Of course we can. What matters is what Iraqis do there to resist, and what matters is what we do here to support their resistance. Now, I feel like somehow there's fear about talking about supporting the resistance, because resistance has somehow become a dirty word in this culture. When we talk about the resistance in Iraq is being equated with terrorism. And I really think we need to stand up to this forcefully. Iraqis are resisting fiercely. They are resisting courageously. They are resisting desperately for their lives and for their country. And so far, I'm sad to say that we on the left, on the anti-war movement, whatever you want to call it, progressive movements, we have responded to their courage with deafening silence. Millions of us marched against the war on February 15th, but you know what? I'm sick of hearing that called the other superpower. We don't deserve to be called the other superpower if we are not responding to what is happening in Iraq right now. Where were those voices when U.S. tanks rolled into Najaf, to the holiest city in the Shiite world? Where were those voices? Where were our voices when Iraq was handed over to a brutal CIA spook and then declared sovereign? Where were they when Ba'athist killers and secret police were brought back to restore order? Where were they when U.S. forces declared war on the very forces in Iraq that are calling for direct elections? Now, of course there were rumors. Of course, many people in this room worked to bring people out to the streets. Many people continue to work against the occupation. But we didn't see the unequivocal torrent of solidarity that I know we are capable of, that we saw on February 15th. You know, I have a friend who lives in Mexico City, and she came to New York last summer when the first revelations about the really inescapable evidence about the way the evidence of weapons of mass destruction were being manufactured. She was in New York City, and she said she couldn't believe that New Yorkers and Americans weren't in the streets rebelling, that they had been lied to about why they were sent to war. And she wrote me this email. She said, "I keep hearing about how there's resistance in the United States, but I kept waiting for it, and it didn't show up. And I thought, well, if it was there, wouldn't they have used it?" And I thought, there was something really strange about the way she phrased it, because I remember thinking the same thing about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Like, if they had them, wouldn't they have used them, right? And I know we tell ourselves we have this power. Like, when the right moment comes, we will really be able to mobilize in the moment of truth. But that moment of truth is always deferred. So if we have these weapons, let us use them. Let us use them now. It's time. Because we have an opportunity here in the coming days, in the coming 2 weeks, to do more than reject war, do more than reject Bush, do more than reject the RNC. We can join with the Iraqis fighting for their liberation. We can demand freedom, demand true sovereignty, demand democracy. Now, we are coming together, it just so happens, on the streets of New York, as the occupation is in a brutal new stage. And I want to be very clear about what this new stage is. This war in Iraq, as you know, is the second war on Iraq, or the third if you count the 98 bombings. But within the last war, this is a second war. This is a second war. The first war was waged against Saddam Hussein and the Sunni elite that controlled the country under his power. And the occupation forces believed that the Shia majority would support them. And most of them did support the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, but they did not support the ongoing U.S. military and economic occupation of Iraq, which are, of course, the real reasons behind the war. And I was actually in Iraq, I was in Baghdad, when this second stage, or this second war, opened up in April. And it was very, very clear what was happening. The Shia majority, represented by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani and more recently, as he's been turned into a hero by the U.S. campaign, Muqtada al-Sadr, have been making very clear political demands since December. They have been calling for direct and immediate elections. They have asked for the constitution of Iraq, and this is a crazy idea. You know, Muqtada al-Sadr is always called an outlaw. Here's the crazy idea, that Iraq's constitution should be written after those elections and not before. Not before by U.S.-appointed politicians. That's the crazy idea. And the other crazy idea, the crazy outlaw idea that they have, is that Iraq should control its economy, that it should control, including its the oil money, including the reconstruction money. Now, at first they made these demands. When I first came to Iraq, these demands were being made with mass demonstrations. They were being made in newspapers, and we were hearing all kinds of celebrations of the free press. There were 100,000 people on the streets of Baghdad in January chanting, yes, yes, elections, no, no, selections, which is what the U.S. was proposing. They held strikes, they held sit-ins. None of this was really reported on in the press. And a friend of mine who I worked with in Iraq told me that they got a copy of a tape that Voices in the Wilderness made of peaceful, nonviolent resistance through history, and it was shots of it was footage of sit-ins. It was teaching them all the tactics of Martin Luther King, of Gandhi, and they watched these videos and they made copies of them, hundreds of copies. They watched them in Hilla and Najaf, and they tried it, and they got crushed. Their newspapers were shut down. Their leaders were attacked and sent to Abu Ghraib. Their peaceful demonstrations were fired upon. Then their neighborhoods were attacked with tanks, with missiles. When I was in Baghdad in April, I sat with children in Sadr City who'd been hit with U.S. mortar fire in their living rooms because they were being collectively punished for living in neighborhoods that supported Muqtada al-Sadr. They weren't being attacked for having a militia. They were being attacked for making demands for genuine economic and political sovereignty that were a direct threat to U.S. military bases, U.S. reconstruction contracts, and U.S. plans to privatize Iraq's entire economy. Now, only when their neighborhoods were attacked, only when their demonstrations were attacked, did the Mahdi army fight back with force. This is how the Second War started. Now, I didn't really keep track of time, so how much time do I have? 3 minutes? In the past 2 weeks, as you all know, U.S. forces have laid siege on Najaf, and they surrounded the Imam Ali Mosque and shrine. The latest news today is that Sadr and his forces have actually pulled out of the shrine, but the fighting is continuing in Najaf. There is no ceasefire. I was also in Najaf in April, and what's striking about it is, you know, this, it's unlike any city I've ever seen before because it is a city of the dead. It is a city devoted to death, to burial. The cemetery goes on forever and ever. There are some estimates that 2 million people are buried there. It's probably much, much more. Every devout Shia dreams of being buried in Najaf, where they believe that they're closest to God. And for the past 2 weeks, U.S. Army boots have been stomping through the cemeteries of Najaf, using tombstones to cut for cover to fire at Mahdi fighters. Now, according to the Washington Post a few days ago, the soldiers are getting pretty spooked by this experience, as you can imagine, because bats are flying out of crypts at them, and graves are opening beneath their combat boots, and they slip. And many of the tombstones have photographs of the dead on them, children, women, mothers, fathers, many of them killed by war and by sanctions. But as the mortars explode all around the cemetery, the photographs shatter from the impact. And there was one quote in the Washington Post from one of the U.S. soldiers, Sergeant Hector Guzman, 28, who lives in Houston. And he said, "Wives, daughters, husbands, you just know you're destroying that tomb. It doesn't feel right sometimes. Sometimes." It's come to this. This is what this war has come to. It has taken the lives of an estimated 37,000 Iraqis, almost 1,000 U.S. soldiers, and now the dead are being desecrated, their graves opened, their memories disrupted. This is the face of the war. And it isn't happening in the past, and it's not an abstract debate about weapons of mass destruction. It happened Wednesday. It happened yesterday. It happened today. It will happen tomorrow. Now, if we are an anti-war movement, we need to fight this war with even more ferocious clarity and determination than we fought the first one. We need to side clearly with the people who are fighting the occupation in Iraq. That doesn't mean saying that we agree with Muqtada al-Sadr's political program. I certainly don't. But there is no question that when he calls for elections, for an end to occupation, for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Najaf, and in fact from the entire country, that we have to bring those demands from Najaf to New York City. That is our job.